Did I do it?
Yep. It's going.
Okay. I have a technical checklist here. Okay, I gotta do that too. Yeah. Okay, I think that's working. So I'm doing what the pros do, where I'm using Zoom, but I also have a secondary camera that can record me in a higher quality, and then I'm going to put you on your side and me on mine. Hopefully you'll be higher quality too, because you'll be smaller, I'm hoping. Like if I take a full, so we'll see. But, oh, and I'm supposed to clap so that I can sync the thingies. You're the first, this is the test.
So. All right, well, that's fun.
Yeah, okay, and then, okay, I did that, okay, good. Okay, well, first of all, of course, as always, I'm really happy you joined me. I've had kind of a summer break by accident where I was trying to figure out what on earth to do with the rest of my life, and...
Did you figure it out?
No, but I'm closer.
Good.
Just kind of the way it goes. Anyways, yeah. I wanted to start by reading something. So first of all, I guess I don't like to do much of an intro. I've had you on before, Pastor Paul Vanderclay. I am Julian. I do the intros differently now every time. It's more fun. In my first episode of the reboot of this show, we talked about, I guess, religion and philosophy, I'd say, lightly. But I saw you tweeting about a homeless man that you interact with and help, I guess, and perhaps some others as well. It was a while ago, so I don't remember the exact details, but I sent you this message, and I wanted to read it out again because it took quite a while to write it, and I thought I said what I wanted to say. So
okay.
Said, "Hello, Pastor. I was just reading your tweets about a homeless man and homelessness. Perhaps like many, I have felt guilty and ashamed, disgusted, awkward, and afraid walking past and often ignoring beggars on the street. Perhaps you could help me develop a more healthy and constructive response. Would you like to come back on my channel to talk about your experiences over the years?" And you'd mentioned that your father had helped homeless people as well, so this was a long-running experience. And I just want to add, too, I thought of this morning, that this isn't a conversation, as far as I'm concerned, this isn't just a conversation about other people, because I don't feel I understand anything, and particularly something like this, unless I can connect it to my own life. And my feeling and understanding is that a lot of maybe the main reasons for people being on the street has to do with addiction and mental health problems. And as far as I'm concerned, while I have not been diagnosed with either of those things, those are things that most people, including me, in some sense flirt with at some point in their life. Sure.
Yep.
Excesses of some kind.
Yep.
And so it's always useful. I don't like to have too much of a moral to any of these podcasts, but personally, one of the things I would hope to get is a greater appreciation for just the value of figuring out how to deal with those sorts of things. So that could be right or wrong, but that's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
And that's, I think, enough from me. So do you have anything else you want to say before we get into it, or do you want to...
Oh, we can get into it.
Okay. So do you... I have no notes beyond this point because I thought, okay, I know nothing. I'm going to go into this completely clueless. For all I know, you've made a million podcasts about the subject. I don't think you have.
I really haven't.
No, that was my feeling, but I don't know. And I didn't look anything up. I just thought, what I told you in my intro and my DM on Twitter is basically where my thinking is at, my experience is at. Right? I know nothing. I've just walked past people on the street. The one other thing was... also what I said in my intro, that I've heard from someone who deals a lot more with the homeless than I, that homeless is perhaps the wrong word, because it emphasizes the fact that they don't have a house, whereas it's really how they got there. And there's nothing, and that's entirely a practical, helpful, compassionate way of looking at it. I don't see any downside to, I'm not big on rearranging words and choosing different words necessarily, but it does sound like, it's convenient, it's one word. But it sounds like homeless is perhaps not helpful in terms of understanding. So
we keep wearing out words because we think, oh, that word develops a stigma, as if the new word we pick isn't going to develop a stigma.
Exactly.
I mean, there's sort of a Pollyannish view to language in there. And I mean, we've been through that for a long time. And I hear now, I mean, a lot of the circumlocutions around homelessness that I hear people offering, someone experiencing homelessness, well, you've just completely infantilized or got rid of that person's agency. It's like, I'm experiencing homelessness.
Yes.
Whereas,
like a side of, sorry, it's like a side effect of a medication.
Exactly.
You experience drowsiness.
Exactly. And so, but they want to avoid, you know, sort of a, an identity label, but that itself is a, not an unpredictable byproduct of sort of our identity happy culture. So let me say this, human beings are, in our culture, prefer to live inside, especially if you live in some place like North America and the further north you go, because it's cold outside. And shelter, especially in a place like California, is, I think the median home price in California is now $800,000 for a single family home. And that is a crazy amount of money. You know, housing has gotten enormously expensive in a place like California. And what that usually means is that those with fewer resources and those for whatever reason who cannot basically live with other people are going to have a very hard time. So there are lots of parts to this, and there are lots of different, you know, if we imagine homelessness as sort of a category, there are lots of different kinds of this. You know, for example, when I was at Calvin Seminary, one of my friends and classmates, yeah, I didn't know this because he kept it a secret, and I was a security guard on the campus at the time. I mean, he slept in his car most of the winter. He was a hardy Canadian, and he didn't have much money, so he slept in his car. And there are a lot of people sleeping in cars, getting cheap RVs, sleeping in those, sleeping at friends' house, couch surfing, it's sometimes called, squatting. You know, maybe, I mean, two of my adult children stayed at my house during the pandemic. I didn't charge them any rent. One of them has since moved out. The other is hoping to move out. But it costs a lot of money to get a lease, rent an apartment, and even a modest apartment. So there's definitely an economic factor involved. But with almost everyone that I've known, there has been something happened. And it's usually relational fundamentally, because they were living somewhere with someone and something happened and that person put them out. So currently there's a guy who's actually been living on the church property for over 2 years now. He's completely without shelter. He's living in sort of the back corner of the property, at sort of the corner of a wall. And he got there basically because his wife just would not tolerate his drug habit anymore. And so she put him out. And he is in his 70s, I would imagine. His grandchildren sometimes come to visit him because a car will pull up over to that side of the lot. And sometimes they'll bring him places. He panhandles at the local supermarket where I buy my groceries. He, you know, to talk to his granddaughter, she'll say he loves the drugs more than he loves anything else. And that's true. So he spends a lot of his time panhandling, getting money for drugs and getting money for food. And that's how he has chosen to live his life for the last few years. Now, it's quite likely he had been developing this drug habit for some time. Now, a lot of the individuals so there are different layers of this. And so I live in not the best part of town, and that's where the church is. And there are a lot of group homes here because in the 80s, California wanted to mainstream a lot of people with mental illness, and that meant starting a group home system. And this neighborhood has houses built in the 60s, which tended to be a little bigger than houses built in other generations, and the neighborhood was depressed. And so often people looking for some kind of income will buy an old home and put as many people as possible in it. Group homes have to be licensed. A lot of other housing are basically just room and board, where someone will own a house and they'll basically rent out as many beds as the neighborhood and code enforcement will allow. And this is in California right now, where a lot of poor people are really living if they don't have family members that they can live with. And those are often the people that wind up homeless. They probably were marginal through a lot of their life. They probably struggled over their lifetime with alcohol, other drugs, usually mental ill. A lot of people that I know who are struggling with substance abuse have some underlying mental health issues, and they're sort of coping with street drugs. That's very common. And so often I'll talk to people and I'll start, I mean, if they come and look for shelter or ask for money, I see that as a license to be nosy and ask about their story. You know, it's not unlike what I do on my channel. And the story patterns develop out of the stories. Many times people had a variety of ups and downs in their life. Sometimes they lived with their parents until their parents got too elderly or died. There was one individual, he's an unmedicated schizophrenic. He lived right down the road. His parents sort of kept him in the house. And then when his parents died, they put the house in a trust for him to live in. Some felons on parole started living with him, sort of taking advantage of him. He had two sisters that were sort of keeping an eye on the place and on him. We worked with the sheriff to get the parolees out of the house. Ironic, once the parolees went out of the house, he actually burned the house down. He's not a medicated schizophrenic. He's not in control of himself in the same world that the rest of us are. He lived in a shed at the church for a while. Eventually, I found someone else who had a room to rent and could probably handle this guy, because he wasn't a very big guy and he was getting up in years, but he could be violent. And with a lot of these people, especially men, the story with women is completely different. But with men, they, if they're not in jail already and they have some mental illness and their homelessness, they've probably pretty much figured out what fights to get into and what fights to not get into. And so I basically found a place that a guy who would rent him a room and kind of take care of him. And that went for a number of years. And, you know, lots of stories involved in helping to make that work. But he had a few resources because he had insurance money from the house and he had his disability. A lot of these individuals are on disability, but managing money is tremendously difficult. And many of them prioritize their drugs and alcohol over shelter. I knew a guy early on in my years here, he would sleep on the church property. He wasn't a schizophrenic. He was just sort of a lifelong alcoholic. I remember he sat in my office one day, put a can of beer on my desk and said, "My life is in that can." And basically the way he managed his life was when the weather got bad, he would sort of tighten up and, you know, get a cheap hotel during bad weather. He was a painter. And so he would work for cash for a guy who had apartments. And basically after someone leaves an apartment, the landlord goes in and repaints the apartment. And so he would go in and he would repaint the apartment. He was a painter by trade. He would get paid in cash, probably had some social security too. And so, you know, homeless, figuring out whether or not to pay for shelter was for him just a question of priorities. And he lived that way for many years. I knew him for a number of years. Many of these individuals, when they live on the streets, getting hit by cars is a big threat. The guy who burned down his house eventually got hit by a truck, wound up in a nursing home, and it's a town south of here. He's still there, to the best of my knowledge. The guy who was told me about, you know, the can, and my life is in that can, he got hit by a car and, you know, was in the hospital for a while. They, you know, stitched together his hips, and then he was living in the bushes in the church across the street with a walker. And so you see a guy who's pretty lame. Now he couldn't really paint anymore because he had been hit by a car. And then he disappeared from my radar, which probably meant maybe he got into a nursing home. Maybe he died. You know, another guy who I've written quite a bit about because he spent about 8 years literally sleeping against my door here, because part of the reason he slept against my door was he knew for me to get in my office, I'd have to ask him to move. And that was just a little bit of civil interaction. He was raised as a Mormon, a very committed Mormon in many ways, even though, you know, how can you be an alcoholic and be a committed Mormon? He's been kicked out of almost all the Mormon churches in the area. Now he's not allowed to come here anymore because he attacked a church member at some point, and there's a restraining order. He's not supposed to be on the premises. So it's just story after story after story after story of this. And, you know, when I got here, the first day I showed up for work, there was a woman sitting with a suitcase in the middle of the parking lot. And a lot of the people at the church here, they didn't really know me at that point. They were worried, oh, what's the pastor going to do about this? Because other pastors had been annoyed, frustrated with this constant line of people. But I had grown up watching my father deal with this. And so for me in a church, mental illness, substance abuse, that was just all part of what churches lived with. And you tried to help people when you could. Often there's not a lot you can do for them. So you try and extend some kindness, show some humanity, but at the same time, don't, you know, try really hard to walk that line and not enable, because you can make their lives worse with your kindness. And so figuring out how to help and not hurt is never, it's sort of an art, not a science. It's, you never get it right. You have to deal with your own conscience. Sometimes you have to manage things. Like recently, I turned off all of the water that was sort of on the periphery, or the obvious spigots. There are some that are open, but there are some of the obvious spigots around the church, basically because a homeless encampment was starting to develop. And, you know, nobody wants to, I mean, the church isn't doing well anyway in terms of, you know, our congregation is aging. Churches try to survive by attracting new members, and people will say, who on earth wants to go to a church where there's all these shopping baskets, there's scary homeless people, there's feces in the shrubbery. You know, there's an inebriated guy sleeping in the parking lot. You don't want to run him over. I mean, it's not an easy thing in a consumerist religious landscape, but at the same time, churches also need to have a conscience, because to just be, you know, draconian about keeping these people away, well, what does that say about your Christian faith? You know, we follow a master who told the story of Lazarus and a rich man. So you're always walking this line, and it's never easy and it's never clear, and you get a lot wrong, but you just keep working it. And, you know, when Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you, 2,000 years later, seems to be holding. And so that's just, you know, a little bit of what I've lived with. At the same time, I think it's vitally important for the health of your soul to walk those lines with people. Because one of the things, as you said in your introduction, one of the things you realize is that none of us are too far from them. Usually what keeps us from that is the capacity to not alienate family that at one point or another, if you do something or I do something that sort of, you know, sabotages our life, someone will take you in. And by the time someone knocks on my door, who I don't know, and asks for money for gas or for bus fare or just food or some help, nobody's hatched into this world. And what that means is, in all likelihood, they have burned through any network and web of family relations that they would have gone through first. And what that often means is that there's likely a power in their life that is stronger than family. Now, not everybody is born into the same kind of family network. And in some ways, the better family you have, the more resistant you're going to be to addiction, the more safety net you have. I mean, strength leads to strength, but dysfunction also leads to dysfunction. And there's obviously structural issues involved there. There's generations and generational and issues involved there. This one particular Mormon individual talks about the fact that his two grandfathers, both of them were alcoholics. So then you look at, you know, there's clearly, you know, something going on in terms of family lineage there. One of them eventually beat the bottle and straightened up and lived into his 90s and, you know, was able to live a clean, decent Mormon lifestyle. The other threw himself off a bridge in the Bay Area and took his own life. And it's between these two poles in some ways that this individual lives. And I've known him for about 10 years now. And so he was here for about seven years sleeping against my door. Then when I went on vacation, he attacked one of the older members of the church that was cleaning up garbage that he would always bring here. And he got violent. That sent him to jail for a couple of years. And then he got out with a restraining order. Of course, he came straight back here. First Sunday, he was free. He walks right into church during the church service. And I looked at him and I said, you know, you can't be here. And so he turned and he walked out. But I've been playing that game with him for almost 2 years now. But the last 6 months, he's 61 years old now. The last 6 months, I've noticed that his short-term memory is shot, because a day or two he'll come to me and he'll ask me a question that I know we had a conversation with, even sometimes just a few hours before. Like when he comes, he says, can I call my father? His father is 91 years old, lives in Utah. And so I'll bring him in, sit him down, call his father, just facilitate that. It's really encouraging for his father. His father just lost his wife, my friend's mother. And so if they can have 10 or 15 minutes of meaningful, positive conversation over the phone, that's generally a good thing. And then he knocks on my door. Can I call my father? I said, you just talked to your father. I did. Yeah. And I hadn't seen that in the last 10 years. So short-term memory is going. When he's in the hospital, they control his bipolar. He's not smoking. He's not drinking. He's not doing street drugs. He's able to eat. He's able to sleep. And if you know anything about bipolar, sleep is a real big issue. He's able to eat. He's able to sleep. Spends 2-3 weeks in the mental hospital. Comes out clean, in his right mind. Immediately back to the beer, back to the pot. I mean, his drug dealer is one of his first calls. And then within a day or two, he's already settling into this. And then now within about a week, he's coming to me and saying, I can't do this anymore. So you want me to bring you to the hospital? Yeah. So then I'll bring him to the hospital, 3 more weeks in the hospital. But, you know, there's a social worker that's trying to help him. But unless he does something criminal, the way the situation is right now in terms of California, unless he does something criminal, they're not going to hold him. And each time they sort of patch him up and get him in his right mind and he feels strong again, he wants to go back to his lifestyle. And then he'll get out and he'll come right back to me. And I'll say, you know, when I see you, when you're out of the hospital, you're looking good. You're looking well. You really, when you're living inside, when you're on your meds, you know, you feel better, you know, your life is better. And he always says, but I'm not going to pay. Basically, I'm not going to pay my money is one of his favorite phrases. I'm not going to pay someone to annoy me. And what he means by that is he knows that for, he gets about $1,000 a month from disability. He knows that if he go about, his only options for housing are a board and care or a room and board. That's going to cost between $700 and $800 a month. So 8/10 of his money, and that'll give him some, you know, a couple of crappy meals every day and a bed to sleep on, probably with some roommates who are very similar to him, mental illness, substance abuse issues, difficult time getting along with people. And so he's a smart guy. He says, you know, I did this for years. I'm not going to do that. So goes, buys a sleeping bag at the local sporting goods store, you know, starts working on the beer. Once he's on the streets, the only, almost the only thing he takes in is beer. And, you know, the beer, the alcohol monkeys with all of the psych meds that the hospital has just been putting into him for the last 3 weeks. And again, now within a few days, he's not wearing shoes. He's shuffling around. He's defecating in the bushes. He's not clean. Then I, Pastor Paul, I haven't slept for 3 days. I know, which means he's manic. And that means that 4 or 5 days from now, he's going to be not getting out of bed, urinating in his sleeping bag. You know, I know this because, I mean, I, at that point I was homeschooling my kids during the day and I would work sort of evening hours. That way I could sort of double shift homeschool my kids in the morning and work in the evening. And he would just lay against that door and I just could hear his self-talk. I'd be sitting here in my office working on my sermon, do stuff. And he was just, he would just lay here cursing his own existence when he was in his low phase. And I just listened to him just, you know, and there's very little I could do for him. There's very little I could do for him. And basically what I was doing for him was letting him, there's kind of an overhang here outside my office. He's kind of sheltered by bushes. You can see people coming. You're up elevated off the street. And so this is the one place he felt safe. And so I basically let him be here. That's what I did until, of course, he attacked somebody. But so I know him very, very well. And he's got an ex-wife. He's got 4 kids who are now young adults. He's a wonderful guy. People love him when he's lovable. But there's, you know, he's been hit by a car a couple of times. He was an athlete when he was young. So he survived one of the last car accidents. He was in a really bad state. I had a guy who at the church who was also bipolar and even more stories with him. He wasn't homeless at that point, but very much had lived a similar life. And I was trying to run a class. And so I told my friend, I said, go see if you can talk to him and see what's going on. And a friend comes back. It's like, he's crazy. Well, I know he's crazy. That's what we're all doing here. So, and at that point he just went out into the street, decided he was going to, you know, do a headlong thing into a car coming 40 miles an hour. Busted his neck, put him in the hospital for 4 months. But then when he got out, right back here. And I've got hours of stories like this. And are there ways? So, you know, when a lot of people drive by and will see him or see others and they'll give money. It's very interesting. Panhandling has really picked up in the last number of years here in California, but almost all of the people I see panhandling outside of church here are not homeless right here, which is very interesting. And so I've done a little bit of research on that because I just go up and ask people questions, say, where are you from? Where do you live? And often it's a little security guard trick I learned when I was in college. If you often ask someone before they have time to think about the question, they'll usually give you a truthful answer, even if it's against their own self-interest. So you just hit them with a surprise question almost right away and they'll blurt out an answer. And so I don't know who's panhandling around here, but they're not the people living in the bushes in this neighborhood because I know these people. And so I very seldom in North America give to panhandlers. I will sometimes give money to people I know. And if I do, I usually try to be generous. I mean, not a dollar or two, give them 10 or 20 bucks because that'll help them. Or sometimes, you know, buy, you know, give them some food or something like that. But people, you know, so I remember once with this one individual, it was his birthday. I know his social security number. I know his birthday because for years I tried to help him, you know, with customer service people on the phone. You always have to give his social security number, his date of birth, all these things. So so one year I thought, well, it's his birthday. Let's do something special. One of the places you can take people to are buffets, all-you-can-eat buffets. If you go to all-you-can-eat buffets, you recognize that, I learned this from a family who had an autistic kid, that you can take your autistic kid to all-you-can-eat buffets, you almost can't take him to any other restaurant because all-you-can-eat buffets sort of tolerate a lot that other restaurants don't. So I go to buffets with these individuals. So I took him to a buffet, an all-you-can-eat buffet right down the road, and I thought this will be something special. He can get whatever he wants, you know. And I was, this was years ago already now, I was quite shocked how little he ate. And I just simply didn't appreciate how destroyed his digestive system had been from all the years of alcohol. One of my first sit down conversations with him was on a bench. We had a bench kind of overlooking the street here, and he was sitting, he was cutting, I don't know what, he was cutting some liquor with whole milk just to be able to get the liquor down. And often he'll drink half and half, because that's even, that even, you know, that'll cut it even more because the fat content is so high. So, you know, it's, I'm sorry. I mean, it's, I'm a combination of two things, because one of the things is you go find old missionaries and you ask them questions and they'll tell you stories until you're really sick of hearing their stories. And same thing with urban pastors. My father finally, you know, when he retired, he wrote a book, and just, I think part of the reason he wrote the book was just because he wanted to tell all those stories, and he couldn't even tell the good ones in the book because the really extreme stories are ones you can't tell, because at least not until the people are dead or their family members are gone, because to tell stories of such degradation, but it's not polite and it's not loving and caring. But as a pastor, especially in a place like this and where my father pastored, you see degradation, and it leaves an impact. And you know, for someone like myself, who I grew up with wonderful parents, you know, godly Christian life together, loved their kids. And, you know, my wife and I have managed to keep our marriage together for 33 years. Food is on the table and in the fridge. You know, I haven't, since I've been working at this church, they haven't failed to pay me. They haven't missed a paycheck. That's a good thing in a church. And so on one hand, I've lived a tremendously blessed life. And at the same time, I've seen and regularly see people who have very difficult lives and sometimes make their even difficult lives worse, sometimes by bad decisions. Sometimes it's just because if you've got mental illness, if you come from a broken home, if you're living in an area where things are already a little bit jungle-like in terms of, well, one of the interesting things that you learn is that there's sort of two levels to society. There are the civilians of people who pay taxes and follow the laws. And in many ways, the police sort of look out for those people. And then there's the, you know, there's the back row America, some might call it, but there's the underside where there's the drug dealers and the prostitutes and the junkies and the alcoholics. And so there's always sort of two levels going on the street, and these two layers bump up against each other. And in many ways, people living on the street are the intersection of those two worlds, because those people living on the street, unlike the people who are doing better sort of in that underclass, they're not able to hide and camouflage and cover. And so they're sort of the visible layer of this shadow world that in a neighborhood like this right here is a big part of the community. And many people in this community are in touch with that shadow world. They might have a son or a daughter who is living on the street. They might have someone who's struggling with mental illness, someone who's struggling with a drug habit or a gambling. I mean, it's not just always substances. It can be gambling. It can be sex, all these different addictions. But you know, even a very affluent community will also have the underside. And so that's just part of life here. And so then often people, they'll go down the street, they'll see a homeless person and they'll feel bad. And a way to deal with feeling bad is give them something. Cause then it's like, well, I feel good about myself because I gave them something. I've watched. So when he was living right here, people would stop the car all the time and give him things. And he was very gracious. Thank you. That's so helpful. And you know, and he was very, people loved giving to him because he could be very friendly and very appreciative. But after they drove down the street, he'd throw the thing away. Because why are they always giving me shoes? I said, that's because you're not wearing any shoes. I hate shoes. I don't like shoes. And so, but everyone would give him shoes and he'd always say, thank you. And they all felt good about it. They'd go down the street and he'd throw it away. And then it was my problem to deal with because the place would be filled with the junk that people would give him.
I want to interrupt you. Do you think that they felt good or they just felt less bad? I think this is a useful distinction between perhaps ways people approach this kind of thing. Like, I'd feel less bad. I don't think I'd feel good about it, but there may be people who would.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you feel bad when you see it?
Because everything about them is screaming out, something's wrong, do something. They are often asking for something, and it seems like my option is to either engage with who knows what or to completely disregard someone who's in need.
Yeah.
So it's like it's an extreme case. Either you get too involved or not appropriately involved.
Right. And my advice to people is usually, now there are extreme cases, and I have guidelines basically. I don't have rules for myself because I will break them often. But my advice for people is, if you want to try to help someone, first of all, you're limited. You can't help everyone. Begin to develop a relationship with someone. And that's far more costly than, you know, $5 or $10 or a McDonald's sandwich or something like that, because it's costing your time. But what that affords you then in the process is understanding. And then you begin to relate to the person as a person. And what you'll find pretty quickly is that some people are willing to have a relationship with you. A lot of people aren't. They want the money. And okay, but now at least there's a little bit more light shining on the situation here. I remember there was a woman a long time over at the grocery store where I shop. She would work the parking lot and she would always come with the same story. And it was a BS story. And the reason I know it was a BS story is because she told it all the time. And it wasn't the kind of story that was an everyday story. It was a one-off story. There was a guy who would call the church, and our diaconate here has always been very generous, which meant that we'd get a lot of calls because we got a reputation for helping people. And so this guy would call and he'd say, you know, me and my mother were in this hotel and my disability is just about to come through and we just got into town. And he'd have this whole story, which basically makes it sound like this is basically a, you know, if I would pay a few hundred dollars for their hotel bill for the next few days, then they would get over the hump and be okay. And that's the kind of giving most of us would like to do. A little help up and they'll be okay. And that's a really good kind of giving. We all wind up in a problem every now and then. But this guy had been working this line for years and he was very organized. He kept a book about all the churches that he would call. And so, you know, eventually I confronted him on it and I said, you know, you've been telling me this story for years. And then he got upset and cussed me out. And then, you know, I guess he had gotten through to a deacon at one point and they'd helped him. And then he had learned that the deacons finally made a rule that they were only going to help someone maybe once a year with this. So then he calls me again. And I said, you know, hey, you know, you and I have had this conversation before. He said, yeah, but your policy is, and I'm like, no, we're not going to play these games. You know, if you're, you know, either be honest with me and, you know, maybe we can work on something together so that you and your mother can maybe, you know, I don't mind putting more money into a person, but don't lie to me about it and have an honest relationship with me. And so that's part of how I deal with the homeless in this area, in that I'm willing to help you, but we're going to have a relationship. And I can deal with 10 years of frustration as long as I know that the relationship between us is honest. I understand you're mentally ill. I understand you have a serious drug and alcohol problem. I understand you have some real patterns in your life that destroy your capacity to build good relationships. And I am going to continue to walk alongside of you and where I can try to make your life at least a little bit better. And where there is a possibility of building on something and getting you to a better place or in a better way, giving you more agency, I'm going to work with you at that. I'm going to work with you towards that. And I don't care if it takes a very long time, and I don't care if it costs me a lot of money, because that's the goal. But what I'm not going to be into is these cheap little transactions that basically enable you to continue to be stuck. And a lot of people are like, fuck you. Okay. There we go. Now we at least know where we're both at. And you can come back to me and talk to me again. I am willing to do that. I mean, this guy has threatened my life. He's done all manner of thing against me. And he understands, though, that there's almost nothing he can do to me that's going to force me to divorce him. But our relationship does have boundaries. And I will enforce those boundaries. And that's how I can live with him. And that's how he has to live with me or without me, because those are my terms. And I think they're generous terms. I think they're the terms I should have, but those are the terms. And the thing is, in any relationship, people have terms. That's the nature of a relationship. So that's why I encourage people. Panhandling, you know, giving to somebody on the corner, you know nothing about this person. And I don't know why you would do it. You're probably better off saving your money if, in fact, you begin seeing someone regularly. Maybe at some point, park the car, go over to where they're panhandling, sit down, maybe share a coffee with them or something, and just start talking to them. build a relationship. And then over time, you will get an eye. If you don't have any, if you don't have any windows into the underworld, you will begin to, you will have an ambassador who will, you know, walk you through the underworld. And, you know, a lot of what I know on the street here is because the people who are living in the living above ground, they don't know what's happening underneath here. People under here know everything. I mean, I know the drug dealer. I know the drugs of choice. I have an idea of the background. Now, a lot of times they don't know a lot of history. And so that's where I kind of come in as a pastor. And if I can sit down and start to have a conversation, and many of the people who have burned through their relationships, if they still have a capacity for a relationship, they're lonely, because a lot of the relationships in the underworld
aren't worth much.
Yeah, it's so hard to generalize, because in the underworld, I've seen enormous generosity. But at the same time, so many of the individuals are so sold out to their habits that they'll betray you in a minute. And yeah, you know, like we had a little jar in the deacon's room once, which had, I think, a couple bucks in from the children's church offering. And I left him in there, and I came back and the money was gone. I said, "Hey, kids gave that money to God. Are you going to take it? I'm a junkie. What do you expect?" Fair point. But, you know, we had a conversation about it. And because part of, at least for this individual, again, who's deeply religious, I know almost nobody in the underworld who is an atheist. I'm not saying they're not there, but they all are religious one way or another. And
okay, hang on.
Yeah,
I got to ask you about that for a second.
Yep.
Do you mean that in like part of what we discussed last time was what it even means to be religious? But I'm trusting you. Do you mean that in like a casual way, like as in believing in a religion or a god, or do you mean more like some they treat something as if it's most important, or like more on a philosophical? You mean
absolutely? I mean it in the way a secularist would define it. They believe in God. Okay. They pray.
Do you know if this ridiculously general question, but do you know if it's they start out that way or they end up that way, or a mix? Obviously, is most likely. But
well, part of
I'm
the
just curious because you mentioned it.
Like, part of the difficulty here is the sampling, and
they are at the church or in connection with you, I guess.
Yeah, and this neighborhood, African Americans, Hispanics, white folks are the most secular part of the population, and right. So a lot of the. But this individual I was talking about is Mormon. He's white. But I, you know, and if they don't believe in, they either have a very thick folk religion where they believe in karma, what goes around comes around. They believe in heaven and hell. They believe even prisoners that I've known have codes that they hold that, you know, you talk to a murderer and they say, at least I'm not a pedophile. You know, it's the people who have abused children. They're really at the bottom of the pecking order, and they know it, but the people on the street, so my friend here, my father told me to not lie and to not steal. This individual lies to me he doesn't actually lie to me much anymore, because he knows he can tell me the truth and it won't break our relationship. So he doesn't lie to me that much anymore, and he doesn't steal from me very much anymore. And he actually always pays his bills. I mean, when he asks me for money, I always give him money, because he's always good for it. He always pays his debts. Even when he's forgetting now, he'll say, do I owe you any money? I could tell him and he would pay, but if I could make it up, but no, I just say, yeah, you owe me $40. Okay. They'll pay me $40. Or sometimes it'll be the end of the month. I'll say, why don't you wait until next couple of weeks when you have it again and you can pay me then. But they all have codes of conduct. And those codes of conduct are connected to God and to demons and to angels and to heaven and hell. That is almost uniformly the case, even though they know, and this is part of their burden, that they are failing the code.
By a lot, because I mean, everyone is probably failing to meet their own expectations as a general rule, but I'm assuming what's significant here is by
these people have stolen money from mothers and fathers. They have betrayed loved ones. Impulse control, obviously, for almost all of these people is not very much there. You know, one day I'm sitting in my office working on something and I hear, I've always got noise going on outside my door, but I hear something. It's like, this is not the usual sound. And you got to understand, we're elevated about 10 feet above the roadway. There's some bushes give a little bit of color. I open the door and here's the guy having sex with another. This woman tends to be semi-homeless. I mean, it's broad daylight. They're doing it right outside my door. And it's like, you know, come on. And, oh, okay, Pastor. And, you know, another day I open the door and here's my friend and his drug dealer and they're sitting there having a joint. And I open the door and the drug dealer's got more scruples. Oh, sorry, Pastor. We probably shouldn't be, it's broad daylight. We probably shouldn't be smoking pot out here on your outside your door. It's not a good look for your church. You think? So, you know, and, you know, and again, if you build a relationship, you can help the people in some ways. You can lend them some of your agency. You know, that's what accountability does. And if you lend them a little bit of your agency, they can have a little bit more. And if they have a little bit more, maybe, just maybe, they'll steal a little less, because this individual has been banned by almost all the stores in the neighborhood because, you know, if he's out of money and he needs beer, he will walk in and he'll grab beer and he'll walk out the door. And of course, the minimum wage clerk is looking like, is this really worth my minimum wage job? And, you know, they'll let him walk out the door. And then the owner will hear about this and they'll tell him, you're banned from the store. And they'll test the ban every now and then, but the cops will come. And, you know, anybody who's currently on the street has learned how to stay out of jail by definition. Right. A lot of more people are in jail, or they go to jail semi-regularly sometimes, but jail, many of these people on the street don't do well in jail because there's tougher guys in jail. And so, you know, they might look like a big deal on the street, but the truth is they're fairly far down the pecking order, because if they had more status, had more capacity, you know, then maybe they could have a girlfriend who would give them a roof over their head. And, you know, I mean, it's just a lot.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's a good thing I didn't prepare any questions, because all I need to do is just let you start and then go. I just, a couple practical questions. We said an hour. So is that a hard thing, like 2:30?
No, we can go a little longer. We can go to, we can go to noon my time.
Oh, right. So I'm telling you my time is complete. Yeah. Yep. Or whatever. I actually don't know what I said. Okay, that's my three. Okay, good. Okay, I think there are a lot of things I could ask, or I could just let you tell me more stories, which would be kind of fun. I'm thinking there's a few things you've said that really interested me. And from the making it more generally useful, what I'm learning from you is everything you said about how to help these people. You hinted at this, is also what you would do in your regular life, with your regular relationships, right? And so you, things such as the walking that line of being helpful, but, or, you know, volunteering your time and so on without it just being either, you didn't say draining you, but obviously it would be if it's not, if it's counterproductive for them, then it's a waste of your time too. If it makes them worse, it's counterproductive. And as far as being, I'm wondering whether it's easier for you to be honest with them than with more civilized people, so to speak, because it's a necessity. Like, I find necessity will sometimes be helpful for that sort of thing.
A lot of lying is sort of social lubrication.
Yeah, I also don't mean lying. I mean more just where you don't say things, at least. That would be where, where that's where I'd get in trouble. If I had a better memory, I think I could count the number of times I've lied in my life. It's not that many, but there's still lots of things I don't say that perhaps I should. Right. And that's something where it would be just that much more dangerous and counterproductive to do that in those relationships because they're more extreme. So, or do you think that that's something you're, like, has this trained you, or do you think you already were naturally okay at that?
I can, anybody who watches, listens to my YouTube knows I can be blunt sometimes, but it's in some ways in a relationship, you have to earn the right to tell the truth, certain truths, instead of looking over them. You know, because, you know, just the other day, you know, often, and people are, I will tell people, I'll say, look, because this spot right outside my office is just prime. It's a semi-quiet street. It's overlooking the main thoroughfare. There's lots of stores here. And again, it's sort of hidden. So if you're in this spot, you can see and not be seen. You have shelter. I mean, it's just prime spot if you're homelessness. It's also right outside my door.
Maybe you could rent it out and then put the money towards a fund to help the people.
Collecting rent from these people?
But luck. Then use it to help them, right? But
the whole point is they don't want to pay rent. But then I'll tell people, I'll say, look, this is no place for a human being to live. There's no toilet facilities here. You know, the shelter is marginal at best. This is not a place to live. And so then there's defecation. There's maybe toilet paper. And so I'll just say, you know, is this yours? Who would ask someone if the turd is theirs? But I do. But in some ways, certain things you gain, certain things you earn the right to ask. And again, that's why I say if someone knocks on my door and they're asking me for money, part of what they're purchasing is part of what I'm purchasing with giving them my time is being able to ask some questions. Now, I know full well I can get lied to. And if I don't have a relationship with the person, even if I do, I can be lied to and fooled. But again, if you build a relationship that affords truth telling. It affords, you know, often, and this is just a general ministry point of wisdom too. You have to earn the right to tell some truths in people's lives. And what I mean by that is there are things we don't want to hear. And we're not going to hear them. And someone needs to have the relational platform to enable that truth to come across and sink into us. And that is only built with trust and time and the giving and receiving of human relationship. That is how you stitch it together. And for almost all of these people, again, by virtue of the fact that they are, some people are short-term homeless that go in and out of shelter. These are not the people I see. Those people, they're dealing with government organizations. They're, you know, the systems are sort of working to one degree for another for them. By the time you have a relationship with me, you have really destroyed your life. You are hardcore. There's all this lingo. They're service resistant. We have such this nice way of, you know, oh, these people are service resistant. Oh, we've sort of medicalized everything, haven't we? So, but okay, so now you're living on my property. I can call the cops on you.
I'm just plugging in my camera. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Keep talking.
I can call the cops on you. I might even be able to put you into jail. I'm in most cases, again, a lot of these guys are smaller. They're not the ones in jail. I can throw away your stuff. I can make your life miserable. If you want to be on good terms with me, you're going to have to enter into a relationship with me, and it's going to cost you something. I'm willing to have it cost me something too. And there again, but this basic giving and receiving, this is the circulatory system of any human relationship.
So I'm just trying to remember, there are a few elements that you mentioned back there about the nature of the relationships you have. Lending agency is an interesting way to put it. I mean, I guess to some degree it might be the case in any relationship, but it seems particularly striking there, because I do have a feel for it, of the degree to which you're describing people who are trapped in their own, in cycles, and trapped in, and you know, I mean, when you're talking about this cycle of, I don't remember the exact period of time, it was a few weeks in the hospital, and then was it only 1 week or a couple of weeks?
Yeah, he's sort of 3-1 right now, hospital time to street time.
Like that's sort of like someone trying to go on a diet, right? And you know, people often who are always trying out diets or exercising, you know, so it's I certainly feel like I have a sense of it. And so the idea of specifically trying to help someone in an area where they're stuck going round and round, it's interesting that's the way it is. So I was trying to think earlier if there was a word instead of homeless that would have more to do with a lack of connections, or just a lack of internal freedom. It's a combination of internal and external. I can't think of a one word that would.
Well, addiction gets at some of it, especially with sort of the John Vervaeke reciprocal narrowing. That John Vervaeke has a friend who has done a lot of work on addiction, and I forget his friend's name, but you know, basically he notes, and this is fortunately becoming more and more well known now, that addiction is not just a certain substance, let's say that it's a biochemical thing merely, but that people who have a lot of good things in their life are far less likely to fall into addiction. Mm-hmm. And you're right, I wish we had a better word for it, but you know, teachers lend agency to students, parents lend agency to children. Children lend agency to parents when their parents get old. I mean, a lot of what true helping is sort of lending agency. And maybe let's say, in fact, it's investing agency, because I'm willing to invest in this person, but I expect to see a return in investment. And I think there's something, you know, as a Christian minister, I see that's something deep in the Christian religion, because the narrative of Christianity is, while we were yet sinners, in other words, while we had no agency to beat off sin using us, Christ died for us. In other words, he invests in us. And that's actually many parables in the New Testament talk this way, expects a return, that I'm investing in you. But now for me, you know, the return of investment I want to see in the people I work with, I mean, it's not that I'm not going to get money from them or something like that. It's exactly what the Apostle Paul says in the New Testament. He says, you are my letters of recommendation. What I want for the people that I work with is, you know, so for a long time, I would talk to this one individual and he'd say, don't try to help me. Well, yeah, that's coming. That's a little bit ironic for someone who's, you know, sleeping outside my door. And then once I'm driving him to the hospital, he's like, why is it always you driving me to the hospital and me not driving you? Well, I don't know. How about the fact that you don't have a car and you lost your license with, I don't know, you know, way over a dozen DUIs decades ago, and you don't have a job, and you're sleeping outside, and you're eating like crap, and I had the kind of relationship where, why are you even asking me this question? And I'm not saying any of it. We have enough of a relationship for him to know. I'm not saying any of these things to harm him, but we can say the truth here. And sometimes he'll tell me some things, which is really hilarious. But that's investing in someone else, because my joy is I want to see you thrive. And so for years, he would say, don't try to help me. All right, I won't. Now we're to the point, you know, a few months ago, I could tell he was at a point, and we sat on the steps outside our office, and we had a really good conversation. I said, you know, you can't afford to live this way anymore. Your body isn't taking it. And this isn't working for you. So let's work on a plan. So we came up with a plan. Of course the plan failed, but we at least got to the point where we could talk about a plan. That took 5 years to get there. And so now we're inching our way towards a plan.
Plans are hard. I have a terrible time with plans. I have a great appreciation for that. Like getting to that point where you have the plan. You're supposed to fail the plan. Then you know the better idea how to make a plan. So I do find the idea Well, I can put it this way. Can you think of any other general guidelines for how to approach helping? I'm going to say helping people who I would find on the street, but with in mind that part of my interest isn't necessarily that I'll do this, but that it sounds like there are a lot of principles at work that would apply to other relationships, just in different degrees. And it's interesting because it's almost like when there's a movie or a story where there's some weird relationship between characters where it's ridiculously honest and it's almost never nasty and it makes it very fun and refreshing. But in real life, those just almost never seem to happen, at least in my experience. And it's weird. Does it take weird circumstances to make that happen? Or is it just that it's more of a thing in the movies, or that it's harder to actually set that up? Are there any further guidelines? I imagine it's partly a state of mind, like to have that simultaneously, you're obviously trying to help. You don't know what helping actually means, so you're curious. And then you're also not overcommitting or giving them things that'll be unhelpful. So
there's a way I can do this with the homeless people that I couldn't do with my wife. Mm-hmm. If my wife were an alcoholic, if my wife was a drug addict, if my wife, that's a different relationship. And, you know, I might have to put her out or divorce her or something like that. So there is a question of how do you two relate? I am not dependent on these homeless people for much of anything. And so I can, in some ways, that is an aspect of the relationship. But the basic dynamics of it aren't that foreign to any of us. And in order to build this kind of relationship, well, I can tell you how it won't be built if you on your side of it can't maintain it. And what that means is you're going to have to not get triggered too easily, not lose your temper too quickly, have a degree of self-confidence and internal security that this isn't going to start, because a lot of these people can be really good at manipulation. And unless you've sort of got a handle on your own neediness or your need to be a savior, you know, these people can run you around a long time because they are experts at this thing. So in terms of who you are, there's going to have to be some things that are true of you. And then maybe it will happen, because there's going to have to also be some things on their side of it. You know, it's not unlike, again, of having a productive romantic relationship or a productive parent-child relationship or even just a productive friendship. If you have a friend who's just very needy all the time or overly sensitive, or, I mean, there's a lot of ways that people destroy friendships. And what that means is that most of their friendships are very shallow around them. Because what if you have an asymmetry in terms of, let's call it relational capacity, what happens is those who are stronger relationally are, again, going to have to lend or invest in the weaker party. And but those who are stronger relationally are in the driver's seat because they can decide, I'm no longer going to invest in this relationship anymore, and they can walk away. But part of that relational security and strength is a durability, which is basically love, that says, this person needs me, but, and I don't need to need them too much, because if you need to need them too much, then you're going to get in a really nasty, codependent, messed up relationship. So it's very subtle.
It's sounding like that's a big part of it, is that, and this I could imagine being able to manage, is that I'm not relying on them for anything. And so much, and it's already an unusual circumstance too, which actually helps. Means I'm not, it's easy to, for people on purpose or just accidentally, in real, I think, to, I don't know if I can express this on the fly well enough, but if you've already got more conventions about how you behave, which is more the case in more normal circumstances, then if you somehow get on you can get on the wrong end of those if someone uses them on purpose or not. And then you actually have to make more of a push to go against that. Whereas in these circumstances, it's kind of more in the wild. And so in that sense, I could see you're both maybe more free to just be honest. And if you can go in not looking for anything back, which I think is something you wouldn't be too hard, and it would get beaten out of you if it was there, because you could you come up with, this isn't a nice question, but are there some examples you could give of helping when it was a mistake, and you could see that it was, you know, retrospectively, so yeah, that was a mistake, that actually what is being, I forget the word you used, I don't know if it was a phrase, I don't know if it was too kind, but something I think of often with all sorts of practical things is that if you're just talking about them, it can seem easy to think of taking a particular approach, but in reality you can't be, I'm not thinking the clearest.
Yeah, I think probably I don't know a lot of those stories because I didn't first build the relationship. And I just was, and usually it was because of expedience on my part. Because here's a situation, I don't have time to invest in this person. I don't have time to get them to know them. So then money just becomes easy. Here's 10, 20, 50 bucks. There, done. Bye. Good. I'll never see you again. And it's just simple. It's really hard to know. And even if with many of the relationships I have now, I often have that fear that, am I helping this person? And, I do a lot of stuff with Freddie, and I have that thought with the Freddie and Paul show often, is this a healthy thing? I don't know. Is this a good idea? I don't know. And I have that regularly with a lot of the homeless people, because, other people, this church isn't my private property. It doesn't belong to me. I work for the church. I am the church's employee. This belongs to the community of people. And often I am far more tolerant of chaos than 95% of the population. And so, we'll often, it's probably true that, I joke about there not being any, young families in my church, but part of the reason for that is probably because I allow scary people to be here. And if you're a mother in her 30s with young children, and there are unmedicated schizophrenics and drug addicts around, you're nervous for your children, and rightfully so. Now, I grew up with my parents taking that wager. And so when I was growing up, heroin was a big deal where I lived. And so I just grew up, and a lot of the men around me were heroin addicts. They were trying to recover. They were sort of living in a halfway house, but I didn't know anything about, you know, the rest of their lives. A number of these people died of AIDS. So, you know, it's so hard to know. There are times when you do something and you just think, I've just perpetuated their stuckness, but I don't care enough about them to let this bother me. I'm also a person who's really low in negative emotions. So
See, I'm pretty neurotic. So
yeah. I don't know. So things don't bother me a lot, which drives my wife crazy. I wish things bothered you more.
Yeah.
I just kind of wired this way, honey. Sorry. You picked me too.
Yeah. I guess there probably are, but it's not a great idea. I wish there was a way you could, you know, just take a pill or do something and to alter various personality attributes for a little while. Like just to be.
Isn't that what drugs do?
I know. That's why I know. I was thinking as I said that a little bit, but I mean in a very precise way. Like, okay, for this day, this one, I'm thinking of, like, you know, Jordan Peterson goes on about the big five. So like, you can just adjust. Okay, I'm going to turn down the neuroticism and Anyway, yeah, it is.
Yeah. And there's not a lot fair about this because, you know, before I found any Jordan Peterson stuff, I read Jonathan Haidt, and he has this great phrase in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, about the cortical lottery. You know, and it just, I won the cortical lottery in some ways. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that helps me now. So one of my sons has two cats and their sisters, and one cat is enormously neurotic and the other is very friendly. And my son jokes, if these cats were in the wild, the friendly one would have long been dead. And the neurotic one, she's a good hunter. And I mean, I came over to his apartment. He lives in LA right now, and here's the cat. And so I kind of put my hand out to see if the cat hissed at me. It's a little friendly cat. And he's like, yeah, but you're just in the way. She wants to run under the bed and you won't see her for the rest of your visit. But she's a great mouse catcher, and she's, you know, so your neuroticism has its upsides too. It's just, you're not living in a context where that's primed for it.
Yeah, well, if you figure out what one is, like for sort of agreeable, somewhat open, and neurotic, let me know.
Oh, you'd survive on the streets.
Why? Because people would like me?
Well, yeah, and your neuroticism would probably keep you out of jail and not getting into stupid fights. So in terms of the underclass, that's a lot of it. These people are surviving. And so that big five personality profile, that cuts different ways depending on what world you're living in.
Right. Okay. So in fact, having gone through a summer of trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, you may have suggested a career path I hadn't thought of. I should explore being homeless.
Go right ahead. You'll learn a ton.
Well, and then I'll I'd know how to help.
you'd certainly know more about how to help. Yeah.
Right.
And,
yes.
And,
yeah.
And I'm people not, have yeah. done that. You know, people have done that. Mm-hmm. I guess the first.
Yeah, I'm
going to first get pastor that. Here used to do that.
Yeah, I bet he wasn't neurotic either. Probably that sounds like a very
because if you're neurotic, you don't do it.
Yeah,
because you have a brain.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but that kind of thing appeals to me, like the idea of really going somewhere to learn how to understand a situation, to live in it. But before we're done, I had a question I meant to ask you at the beginning. I have seen your last name written as one word and two. And I have written it, I think, both ways on our first YouTube. I changed it. So for the record, Is it two?
Yes.
Okay.
But sometimes I push it together as one because for, so it was always two, and that was fine, especially if you live in a place like West Michigan where there's a lot of Dutch names.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then when computers came out, computers didn't recognize spaces in last names. And so the space has been a mess, and my poor children and my wife, they're like, every time you're trying to think about, okay, what was the account I had with this company? Did I put the space in or not? And I mean, it's just a mess, but two word last names are more and more common in America, and computers are more sophisticated. So it's not the problem it used to be. So either way is fine.
Okay. I do try to get that kind of thing right. But it was funny when I first ran into it. I think, what could I possibly have done? Oh, I know. I didn't even capitalize the K. Like, I had it all went together, but the K wasn't capitalized. And that seemed to me like a fairly major error. So I just thought it was funny. My first video of my new podcast, and then I don't even get the person's name right. But anyway.
Well, Ellis Island started all the confusion when my great-grandfather came over. And the name, see, part of what's nice about this name is I always know if someone is related to me in the U.S. or Canada, because only via my great-grandfather is the name actually this way. Because that's not even the way it was in the Netherlands. But in the Netherlands, too, it was a bunch of when the Dutchman had to take on last names, the Jews just kind of made some stuff up, and that's how we got our name.
Okay. Last really important question, which I try to ask everybody now. Does it sound to you as if I have an accent?
Sound a little Canadian.
Okay. Because I just realized that just because I don't hear people as having an accent doesn't mean that they don't hear me as having one. And that just seems intriguing. And since my show is primarily about perspectives, I thought, in a way, what's one of the most fundamental things is whether you perceive someone as speaking with an accent or speaking funny. I was told that essentially by another guest. So, yeah.
Everybody's got an accent.
Hmm?
Everybody's got an accent.
That someone commented that. Yeah, I know that's not the point, but the point is, relatively speaking, whether it sounds to you like I do, because to me, you don't sound like, I don't hear an accent, so it could be the same as mine, put it that way.
I don't know why I don't have a North Jersey accent. Every now and then someone will listen to me and they'll say, you grew up outside of New York City, didn't you? I'll say, yeah. And there's a few key words that I'll say and they'll hear it. But my mother is from Massachusetts. And so for years, we would go on vacation up there. And the closer we got to her hometown, the more her accent would come out. And I always thought that was amazing because she wasn't doing it intentionally. We're really mysterious creatures.
Yeah. The other thing I'm thinking too is it's also more the, I'm not even sure what the right word is, intonation or cadence or something. Because I've heard a few people lately who really sound Canadian to me, and I wasn't even sure I would know what Canadian sounded like. And I think they're both from British Columbia. And I thought, well, maybe that's, but it, that's more the, it's not the actual pronunciation, it's something else. But anyway.
One of my sons now has a girlfriend who's from Louisiana. And it's just so much fun. She's got that Southern accent, and it's just a delight. So accents are fun.
It's amazing how much fun they are. I don't understand why it seems so often like it's more attractive for someone to have a different accent. There's almost no accent that I would dislike in general. I don't see why that would be. But anyway, that's... Okay, this has been good. I think this is something, it's hard to keep it short, like it's either short or really long. If you're interested, I'd love to have you on in the future just to talk more. Otherwise, I'll look for other people. I haven't looked at all. I'm pretty sure there's got to be a whole bunch of stuff on YouTube, YouTubers. I'm pretty sure there are one or two homeless people who are on YouTube.
I've often tried to, I've wanted to get more video of some of these individuals. Part of the problem is for some of them, it's sort of unfair because they have no idea what the implication of being on YouTube is.
I ran into that once. I had the opportunity to interview someone who appeared to have amnesia, long-term amnesia. So he had no idea about his previous life other than what people had told him, or he had very small glimmers. And so for him, it was the way it had worked. It was, I forget the period of time. It was like he'd lost 30 years.
Wow.
So there was a marriage. There was, I started to wonder whether he made it up, but anyways, but the point is, so the internet, basically he went from no microelectronics to now. Wow. The way his memory worked. So I thought this would be neat, but I thought, I don't think he can consent properly. He doesn't know what's yeah. happening, and it might yeah. be fine, but it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
It was interesting too, because it seemed like, this is what he thought, it actually had changed his personality so that he'd been this miserable, you know, almost like a Scrooge sort of character, like just oddly miserable. And that somehow when he'd lost all his memory, he just sort of was more in the moment. And so he was much more pleasant. So he thought it improved him. It was,
wow.
It was neat. It was a neat story, but
wow.
Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, there's people are amazing. And one of the, if you can find a way to shine a light and help everyone see the different ways that individuals are amazing, there's no end to a desire to see that glory. So it's mm-hmm. really cool. So
mm-hmm. yeah, it's an interesting.
Yeah. Let me know what you want to do with this. You know, I'd be happy to post this on my channel at some point, but if you want to put it on your channel for a while first, that's fine too. It's totally up to you.
Oh, yeah, that's a good strategic point. If I could put, assuming I can assemble mine properly from the different video sources, and my new fancy camera ran out of juice partway through. It's supposed to have a battery I thought that lasted forever. I could have plugged it in. I didn't. Anyways, so we'll see how that goes. I think at this point, it'll either go back to the normal split screen, or I'll be in the dark and we'll just show you. I don't know at this point what I'll end up doing okay. with the video, but
well,
yeah,
I'll wait to hear from
yeah.
you.
If I could put it up yeah first for a while, because what happened last time was I got an amazing number of views on your channel, which was exciting and made me think I was going to be famous in no time, and then almost not very much on my channel at all, which was fine because it just started. But then I thought, yeah, if I'd done this first, because you're, you know, moderately famous on YouTube, if I put you up yeah on mine first, maybe it'll get more draw. So yeah, give it a couple weeks or something.
Okay. Okay, that sounds good.
That'd be great. Yeah, unless I've just wrecked all my footage somehow. But yeah, I'm really happy we did this, and I wasn't sure how it would turn out, but I feel improved by it, and hopefully other people do too. So
all right,
thanks a lot. Maybe see you later.
Okay, take care, Julian.
Okay,
bye-bye.